the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. We are still, as a nation, trying to take the measure of Martin Luther King Jr. and his meaning for America. And today, on the day set apart to recognize Dr. King and his legacy, we're going to take the opportunity on this program to revisit this question. And from a Christian perspective, to try to come to terms with what this man's mission was all about, and what the meaning of Martin Luther King Jr. and the Civil Rights Movement is for America today. We're going to have a very special guest and a lively conversation. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. First, a review of some of the issues in the news. We're doomed. That is the message from James Lovelock. He is the author of the famous Gaia Hypothesis. And he's out with a new book, and it's The Revenge of Gaia, and he's out with some articles in The Independent and in London, and you can count on them coming to this nation as well. Now, the Gaia hypothesis, first of all, is very easily made fun of. James Lovelock is a radical environmentalist who about 30 years ago developed the hypothesis that the world is basically sustained by a planetary control system that has a personality. In other words, he gave the cosmos a personality. And not only that, but a feminine personality, something like a radical updating of the idea of Mother Nature. Well, all kinds of people have embraced this. The radical ecological fringe, they love this because, after all, this tells them that human beings are an imposition on the planet. The New Agers like it because they developed all kinds of spiritualities coming out of the idea of Gaia, and the feminists love it because a woman's in charge, basically a female personality of Gaia. Now, the Gaia hypothesis has influenced people. You'd be surprised. Prince Charles, maybe you wouldn't be surprised it's influenced the British Prince of Wales, but it has influenced others as well. It has made its way into university curricula. But now he's back, James Lovelock. He hasn't been heard from a time. He's written a book. It sounds like a science fiction movie, The Revenge of Gaia. But he is now saying that we've simply passed the point of no return. What I think makes this interesting is that Dr. Lovelock says, look, following his thesis, he says, we messed it up so badly at this point, there's nothing we can do to turn it back. He says, we're in for about 10,000 years of climatological chaos. We're doomed. I'm reading from what he said here. He said, the climate centers around the world, which are the equivalent of the pathology lab of a hospital, have reported the Earth's physical condition, and the climate specialists see it as seriously ill, and soon to pass into a morbid fever that may last as long as 100,000 years. I have to tell you, as members of the Earth's family, and as an intimate part of it, that you, and especially civilization, are in grave danger. It really would make a great science fiction movie. Gaia's back, and she's mad. Well, what's really mad is the fact that people take this idea seriously. Three separate articles in The Independent of London, one of the major British newspapers over the weekend. This book will be released the first week of February in Great Britain. Very quickly, it'll be over here. Just brace yourselves for The Revenge of Gaia. It's going to be in the news. Speaking of in the news, the Los Angeles Times has a fascinating opinion column today by Neil Ferguson, he of both Cambridge and Harvard universities. In Tomorrow's World War Today, one of the world's leading historians writes as if he were a historian looking back at a world war at the end of this decade. This is what he says. Prior to 2007, the Islamists had seen no alternative but to wage war against their enemies by means of terrorism. From the Gaza to Manhattan, the hero of 2001 was the suicide bomber. Yet, Iran's President Ahmadinejad, a veteran of the Iran-Iraq War, craved a more potent weapon than strapped-on explosives. He aimed to give Iran the kind of power North Korea already wielded in East Asia. The power to defy the United States. The power to obliterate America's closest regional ally. Under different circumstances, it would not have been difficult to thwart Ahmadinejad's nuclear weapons program. The Israelis had shown themselves capable of preemptive airstrikes against Iraq's nuclear facilities in 1981. Similar strikes against Iran's were urged on President Bush by neoconservative commentators throughout 2006, but the president was advised by his Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, to opt instead for diplomacy. Americans did not want to increase their military commitments overseas. They wanted to reduce them. Europeans did not want to hear that Iran was about to build its own weapon of mass destruction. Even if Ahmadinejad had broadcast a nuclear live test on CNN, they would have said it was a CIA trick. So history repeated itself. As in the 1930s, an anti-Semitic demagogue broke his country's treaty obligations and armed for war. Having first tried appeasement, offering the Iranians economic incentives to desist, the West appealed to international agencies, the International Atomic Energy Agency and the United Nations Security Council. Thanks to China's veto, the UN produced nothing but empty resolutions and ineffectual sanctions. End quote. Now, I was just reading there from Niall Ferguson's projected history of the end of this decade with a world war focused on the Middle East. And let me tell you, the most tragic piece of his picture is that it ends with a catastrophic nuclear exchange between Israel and Iran. Now, when we were talking about the Gaia hypothesis, I dismissed it as science fiction dressed up as a serious idea. What makes Niall Ferguson's article truly frightening is the plausibility of what he suggests here. There are those looking in the Middle East who are seeing in Iran's absolutely fanatical determination to develop nuclear weapons the setup for the most devastating threat to world peace since World War II. Now, historical perspective is always very difficult to gain when you're looking in the present. But Niall Ferguson, if anyone, has the credibility and the right to speak from an historian's perspective. He is one of the great historians of our age, one who understands the big picture, and one who understands that present decisions are indeed very important. What are we going to do about abortion? Well, the New York Times has a very fascinating front page story today, and it suggests that one thing that could be done is to forego politics for quiet talk. It looks in particular at a Women's Choice Resource Center here in Louisville, Kentucky, and it looks at the ministry of this particular women's center toward women who are contemplating abortion, towards women who have had abortions, and towards women who have foregone an abortion, chosen life. It makes very clear that all across this country there are some outstanding programs for women, largely Christian ministries, that try to reach women who are considering an abortion and offer them some very real assistance, some very credible information, and especially through the use of technology such as ultrasound, enable them to see the unborn baby in their womb and make a decision for life. But, you know, one of the canards, one of the false arguments that is often alleged against those who are pro-life and anti-abortion is that we care only about the unborn infant. One of the exciting things about this New York Times article, and again, it was published today in the nation's leading newspaper, is that it makes very clear that a Women's Choice Resource Center in Louisville, Kentucky also cares about women after they've made the decision to keep their baby. A decision for life. And as a matter of fact, it gives coverage to the opening of a new center here in Louisville as a part of this ministry that is particularly directed towards women and in terms of programs to help them in parenting and financial planning and all kinds of other things, even computer use, so that they can have fulfilling and useful lives and self-sustaining income even as they are raising the children they have brought to life. Now, it's good news when any kind of media coverage like this is directed towards the pro-life movement that makes clear it's not just what the enemies of the pro-life movement would suggest that it is. It's not just about political action. As a matter of fact, a Women's Choice Resource Center came out of the decision of some very serious pro-life Christians that standing around holding signs and protesting outside clinics just might not be the most effective way to reach women. And I just want to, again, direct your attention to this news article. All the issues I've discussed here today in the articles are linked off of my blog at Albert Mohler, that's MOHLER.com, and you can go there and find this. One word of personal disclosure, I need to tell you that my wife, Mary, is a member of the board of directors of a Women's Choice Resource Center, a fact of which I'm very proud. I've spoken at many of their events, and I really believe in what they're doing. And I think it is just great that the New York Times has seen it worthy of nationwide coverage. Page one of today's edition of the New York Times. On a scarier front, while we've been talking about things ranging from science fiction to historical fact, British scientists, including Ian Wilmot, the scientist who cloned Dolly, the first cloned mammal, the cloned sheep, now announced they're going to try to create a new being in terms of embryonic research using eggs from both humans and rabbits. Now, in this case, you're talking about a trans-species boundary that is being crossed. You're talking about the development of what is known as a chimera. Now, when the Greeks first started talking about chimeras, it was science fiction. human-animal combinations. Now, those who are doing this in Great Britain will say they're not going to try to bring some animal to life. They're not trying to create some rabbit-human hybrid. But they are mixing the genomes between the rabbit and the human by using these two eggs. They say it's something like a shortcut to embryonic stem cell research. But many of us think it's going to be a shortcut to disaster. Again, I have an article on this at my weblog, Albert Mohler, MOHLER.com. Folks, there's no shortage of important issues to be the ground of our discussion. But today is Martin Luther King Day in the United States of America. We're going to be talking about the legacy of Dr. King and the Civil Rights Movement and our Christian responsibility today. The phone number, 877-893-8255. I'm Albert Mohler. Welcome back, folks. The black-white divide in America has been a fact from the very beginning of this nation's heritage. As a matter of fact, in 1835, the most insightful foreign observer ever to come to the United States of America, Alexis de Tocqueville, wrote this, and I quote, "I do not imagine that the white and black race will ever live in any country upon an equal footing, but I believe the difficulty to be still greater in the United States than elsewhere." Now, in one sense, those words spoken in 1835 proved to be an understatement because just... 30 years after they were spoken, America was in a civil war, a brutal and bitter civil war. In fact, the kind of civil war that many nations simply do not survive over the issue of slavery, and at the heart of the question of slavery was the issue of race. And then you have to fast forward almost 100 years from 1865 to 1965 to come to the very height of the civil rights movement in the United States. And then you encounter, of course, the central personality of Martin Luther King Jr. And on this day, the 20th annual observance of Martin Luther King Day in the United States of America as a federal holiday, we're going to try to take the measure of the man all over again. Now, in the course of the program today, we're going to hear a little bit from his speeches, and we're going to be talking about the actual content of his ministry and his leadership. We're going to be talking about the context of the age as well, because that's something that is missing. Now, looking 40 years after, say, 1965, much less 1963 or 1968, we're looking at the difficulty of distance because many, if not most of the persons listening to me today, were either not born yet or were children, as I was, during the time these pivotal events were happening. With me in the studio today is Kevin Smith. He's the Martin Luther King Jr. Fellow at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and a man who has given enormous thought to this question as well. Kevin, it's great to have you with us.
It's so good to be here with you, Dr. Mohler.
Now, when we're talking about Martin Luther King Jr., you know, immediately certain things come up. And let me just say there are two polarities, and I think we can illustrate both of these very quickly. Number one, I think there are those to whom or for whom Martin Luther King Jr. is something like a secular saint, someone who is the very epitome of what they believe the greatness of America can and should be. And they see him as a moral prophet in the midst of a day of tremendous moral confusion. And then you could go to the other side, and trust me, I've gotten the email because of my article published in the last 24 hours. I've been getting the email, and for instance, someone who wrote it and said, how can you even talk about Martin Luther King as a moral hero because he was a deeply immoral man with flirtations with communism and sexual immorality and all the rest, and plagiarism in his doctoral dissertation? Those two polarities represent at least two ways Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is seen. How would you suggest that we should see him?
Well, by me having a Christian worldview and a biblical understanding of humanity, I can fully embrace the flaws and the depravity of Dr. King and yet appreciate his contributions as an outspoken critic of America not fulfilling its dreams and its promises as laid out in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. But I do understand the frustration, especially in the day that we're living in. So many of our political leaders and religious leaders are showing moral character faults that just ought not be displayed. And so there's a lot of disillusionment with leadership in general.
Yeah, I think one thing, and you've mentioned this, in terms of the Christian understanding of humanity and of mm-hmm. sin, we know that none of our leaders is perfect, not one of them. There are flaws. Every one of them is a sinner. But we also know that there are some whose sin is particularly egregious, particularly extreme, particularly perhaps even indicative of the deeper character. And these are difficult issues to balance in terms of the public square, I think. But there's something else here, and that is when we look at Martin Luther King Jr., we're looking at a man who literally put his life on the line for a cause. And here's the thing. I think there's an enormous amount of guilt on the part of white Americans, especially those who were alive and adults at the time, in knowing that on the central question that he really forced in this country, he was right.
Yeah, yes. On the, that central thrust never changes. Despite Dr. King's humanity, the central thrust of his argument cannot be dismissed. As you said, since America's foundings, we have struggled with the issue of equality and race, and I believe that even today, black and white, Hispanic, Asians, we all are convicted by his call for a society where equality can really be the order of the day.
Let's just go back 40 years, actually about 42 to 43 years. Let's go back to August of 1963 when Martin Luther King Jr., under the glare of incredible political intensity, and social unrest that was leading to violence in the streets and all the rest, went to the Lincoln Memorial and to the steps of that great central feature in Washington, D.C. on the Mall, and gave his most famous speech. Let's listen to just a little bit of it. And in listening, we'll hear something of the cadence of the times and something of the prophetic nature of his message.
But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro has still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. And so we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition.
The reason I chose that particular section of this speech is because of the last words. He said, "We come here today to dramatize a shameful condition." Now, Kevin, we just need to talk about the fact that it was a truly shameful condition, and a condition that was largely blind to a lot of Americans. I was 4 years old when Dr. King gave that speech, soon to be four. I know nothing of, and I have no active memory of that speech or of the event. But since growing up and having grown up in the South, I now know that I myself was a part of a system of segregation and all the rest that that frankly most Americans today could not even imagine had existed so recently in our history.
I agree. It is mind-boggling. And I think even what takes us to deeper thought are some of the realities of that condition that we still see in our society today. I'm fortunate to be able to speak in a variety of Christian settings, and even particularly troubling among Christians, we still have these various issues as far as racial segregation and even understanding each other, appreciating cultural differences, appreciating personality differences. It's a sad condition, and I pray all the time that the Spirit of the Lord would kind of put us in a mood of Acts chapter 2, be in one place on one accord, similar to the day of Pentecost. And if that's happening in the church, you know, what do we expect from the broader society?
Well, when we come back, we're going to talk about the political context of Dr. King's message. And, you know, one of the things that has always perplexed me, given my own generational placement here, is that I hear people talk about Dr. King as extreme. And yet when I look back at his actual placement in history, he was really anything but. As a matter of fact, he was having to hold off forces from the left, far more radical, who were not committed as he was to nonviolence, but were ready to use violence. And that soon led to violence in the streets of America, and we should be thankful, something like 40 years later, that it was not worse than it was. Folks, if you want to join the conversation, the number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're talking about the meaning of Martin Luther King Jr. and how we as Christians in this generation should think about the man, his message, and his moment in history. Coast to Coast, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Taking the measure of any man is difficult, especially those who live in controversial times and have a controversial message. Those who are declared and understood to be prophetic in the issues that they champion and the causes that they begin to represent. And, you know, when you go back to the 1960s in America, let's just face, on the one hand, you had official segregation. You had black Americans who were denied the right to vote routinely. You had voting registration clerks all over the South, very, very proud, publicly advertising that African Americans were not allowed even to register to vote. You had the denial of all kinds of privilege. You had not only a multi-class society in terms of the socioeconomic realities. You had an American form of apartheid that was very much in place. It is to our nation's shame. And let's just say that even today in the third world, we are still reaping the legacy of America's shame during that era. We lost a lot of moral credibility when we did not live up to our ideals. And Martin Luther King Jr. came to leadership in the civil rights movement largely through the power of his personality and the incredible soaring oratory of which he was so uniquely capable. He was not a saint. And one of the things we as Christians must always do is point out that this kind of secular hagiography, that is the attempt of the secular world to create secular saints, needs to be punctured with Christian realism. The man was a sinner. He was at times caught in sexual immorality. He was not in every way a man that I would want to emulate. But on the cause of civil rights, he was right. And not only that, there are those who, with a secular perspective, would say he was simply there for the times. No, I have to have a providential understanding of history as a Christian, and I have to believe that the Lord's good purpose was for Martin Luther King Jr. to give leadership at that time. Because what we now know, and some did know at the time, but most Americans did not know, is that the forces of violence were coalescing. And you just look at the deep cleavage in the African-American community between Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X. And you see where that was headed. And then you know what is going on. And Dr. King's commitment to nonviolence and to the nonviolent protests, it really changed America. Let me mention to you, if you are looking for a way to gain an understanding of the times, I don't think there's any better way to do so than by reading Taylor Branch's magisterial, and I would have to say massive, History of the Civil Rights Era. It is a three-volume work. The last of these volumes just came out in recent days, entitled At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 1965 to 1968. His first volume, Parting the Waters, won the Pulitzer Prize. And the three volumes together really represent several thousand pages of documentation, actually. You learn so much, I have to say. My guest today is Kevin Smith, the Martin Luther King Jr. Fellow at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. I have to say, Kevin, as I read this work, that the placement of the civil rights movement in American history is something that I think most people in my generation, not to mention those younger, simply don't know.
I agree. If you would chart significant events, I think you would, of course, chart the Constitutional Convention, you would chart the Civil War, you would chart Reconstruction, and then you would chart the early 20th century, and then the Civil Rights Movement is the next significant, the late 50s and the early 60s is the next significant chapter of American history that really directed our paths to where we are now.
Now, one of the things that Taylor Branch makes so clear, and one of the reasons I appreciate his book, is because he has an historian's eye for detail. But he also keeps us always looking at the big picture and the flow of history. And as a matter of fact, it is not a biography of King. It's entitled, the subtitle of all three volumes is America in the King Years. But King is the figure that kind of becomes the symbol of what is happening. But Taylor Branch makes clear the political context was so very complicated. You had President Lyndon Johnson, who did push through the Voting Rights Act with the capital that he gained right after his election and after the assassination of John F. Kennedy Jr. But he makes very clear that Johnson was for voting rights, but he was very much opposed to King's methods of public confrontation and the marches and all the rest. You had J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, who was doing everything he could to discredit King, because the only thing he really cared about was whether anyone had ever met with a communist at any time, and King had, because on the extremes of American calls for social change, there were Marxists and communists and Maoists and others that people just, again, largely don't know had incredible influence and could have given leadership to this movement. One of the crucial questions we have to face in the year 2006 is how might this story have ended differently? And, of course, we really can't say it's ended, but how might it have really gained and taken a different trajectory had there been other leadership? And, of course, when we talk about Martin Luther King Jr., we have to talk not only about his great speeches and not only about the political impact of his life and message, we have to talk about the impact of his assassination as well in 1968. That's what we'll pick up when we'll come back. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. My guest today in the studio is Kevin Smith, who is the Martin Luther King Jr. Fellow at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Interesting story about how that entire position came about. Dr. King spoke here in our chapel, and his mother had played the organ here at one time for another meeting, and so there was a family connection, and it was very controversial in the 1960s for Dr. King to speak in this chapel. As a matter of fact, my predecessor as president had some people who wrote angry letters, and one of them wrote and said, we will no longer give to the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. We will no longer have anything to do with you for having Dr. Martin Luther King in the chapel. And Dr. Duke McCall, who was president at the time, simply used the SBC formula to figure out how much money this church had given anyway and wrote him a check back for all the money they'd ever given and told them that he didn't need their money. It just reminds us of how volatile all this really was, this whole situation. And because of the historical tie to Dr. King being here on the campus, that's why we have this fellow program. And it really is a way of seeking to minister particularly to African-American students here on the campus.
Yes, I'm thankful for the opportunity to share in this ministry. And I think many people are at least informed to realize the historical connection between the seminary and Dr. King and his ministry here in Louisville.
All right. Let's talk, though, going back to 1963 again and the great speech. Let's talk about the central content of Dr. King's message. And I was not old enough to understand or appreciate what in the world was going on in 1963, but I can still remember as an adult the first time I listened to this entire speech. I want to take you to the first part that really grabbed me, that I understood it was the very heart of Dr. King's message, and that's what we want to listen to. It's a little long, but we don't want to miss it.
So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yeah. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
That central line, I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character, is to me the greatest moral force of Dr. King's message. And when I listen to this part of the speech, I just listen to it over and over again, I have to wonder who could possibly disagree with this? Who could possibly say that this is not absolutely right? Who could possibly say that this is not exactly what God would have wanted said? Kevin?
Hard to believe that this is the middle of Dr. King's activism. Hard to believe that after this speech, he encountered so much opposition, not only from white citizens, but also from black citizens.
Now, explain that. You know, I think a lot in our audience would understand what you said first, but not what you said last.
Well, for one thing, at the beginning of this quote, this clip we played, he says, we're used to the language, I have a dream, but he starts out with saying, I still have a dream. By this point, 8 years after 1955, there's a lot of frustration building in the black community. There's a lot of what you referred to as earlier as radicals. And also he says that the dream is rooted in the American dream. By now, there are people in the black community ready to check out on America. Black separatists, black nationalists, ready to check out on the American project. And so the one of the benefits, I think, of Dr. King is that Dr. King still maintain hope in the project called America, in the dream, in the vision of America. And his call was for America to fulfill its dreams, which is a much different call than the call to leave America, or the call to, by violence, restructure America, or the call to separate from America.
Yeah, you know, one of the things, and I mentioned Taylor Branch's third volume just out at Canaan's Edge, one of the things that I really appreciated of his closing chapter on the King years, he mentioned that King's oratory mined twin doctrines of equal souls and equal votes in the common ground of nonviolence, and justice refined history until its fires dimmed for a time. But he also speaks of the fact that that Dr. King basically just condensed the entire American project into this theme of freedom.
Yes. I want to highlight this, Dr. Moeller, that and when this speech was given, Dr. King would have been at the top of the popularity list in the black community. But by 65, 66, 67, Dr. King had significantly dropped in popularity.
And tell us why.
Because Dr. King's vision was rooted in the American dream. He did not want to upset the project or what we would call the rule of law. He did not want to upset America. And also, Dr. King really believed in equality. So he was not trying to flip-flop white supremacy for black supremacy. He merely wanted, as you listed in the quote here, where his children would be judged on the content of their character, and that would apply to all people. And so for many in the black community, Dr. King was not even radical enough for their desires.
So where does that take us today, 2006?
2006, I would love for your listeners to look at Dr. Branch's volumes, because they span Dr. King's years. And I think many times we isolate Dr. King. If we would look at 1955, 1963, 1967, and 1968, we would get a much more complex picture of Dr. King.
Well, what about that vision in 2006? Is it still alive in the African-American community?
Yes, but there's still the same divides. There's still those who believe in the hope of America, and there's still those who want to say, let's can the project.
When we come back, we're going to talk about how Christians of all races need to reframe this question, not only for new times, but in light of the everlasting gospel. We have to have a unique understanding of this, because we know the even bigger story. I'm Albert Moeller. Welcome back. I'm very glad to have in the studio Kevin Smith, the Martin Luther King Jr., a fellow at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. We've been talking about the legacy of Dr. King from a Christian understanding here in the year 2006. And where we went out from the last segment was with the question, what does this mean for Christians today? I have to say, Kevin, I think this means that for conservative Christians, conservative evangelicals, we have to know that the cause is even more just and even more important than the folks who were marching in the streets did in the 1960s. Don't you think so?
I do believe so. One thing that's been so encouraging is in the things that have happened in the last 25 years in evangelical life, particularly in the Southern Baptist Convention. The issue of race has consistently been the issue that has received attention, and I think it merits, even whether that was among liberals or especially among conservatives, because we want a biblical understanding and we stick to the biblical commitments of equality as creatures of God, as men and women created in the image of God.
Okay, Kevin, I told you I was going to ask you the hardest question, and here it comes. And it's really not to you, it's more about me. And that is this. One of the things that haunts me is knowing that that liberal Christians, who I think are so wrong on so many issues of doctrine and get the gospel wrong and deny the power of the Word of God, they were so right on this issue when a lot of conservatives who should have known better were so wrong. How did that happen?
I struggle with how that happened, but my hope and my optimism is that that situation has so changed today. I have been fortunate to meet and encounter many leaders of my own denomination and other evangelicals, Bible-believing evangelicals, and have found them to be true brothers and sisters in Christ who are feeling the burden for us as the church to demonstrate what community is all about. I do think that America, I don't have a lot of disappointment with culture at large when the church has provided no real model of community and reconciliation. I'm burdened when I see false religions and cults, and you get a glimpse of them and they're multicultural, and then I see my Bible believing brothers and sisters and you get a glimpse of us and we don't have the same pictures. And so I'm very challenged that we as Christians who have a Christian worldview would feel the burden to model for the world, just as we model in pro-life, just as we model in marriage and commitment, that we would model racial harmony.
Just as the Bible directs us in the book of Revelation to that vision of all the redeemed before the throne of God, men and women from every tongue and tribe and people and nation. If God draws pleasure from seeing that picture, then we better seek, even in this age, to try to see it among ourselves. Every tongue, every tribe, every people, every nation. My guest today has been Kevin Smith, the Martin Luther King Jr. Fellow at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. We've been looking at Martin Luther King Jr., taking the measure of the man, his message, and his moment in history. I'll meet you tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.